Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
I'm Lyle. I watched a movie called Margin Call over the weekend.
Good.
It was okay. I guess you say it's loosely based on the financial crisis.
Oh.
Like, of course, the firm that they work for is not Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch or the Lehman Brothers or anything like that.
But,
and it was very, I don't want to say overacted or hammy.
Soap opera-esque.
Dramatic. It was very dramatic.
So quoting Shakespeare in the boardroom?
To sell or not to sell?
It's like Jeremy Irons was the chairman of the firm. And he's like, my job is to hear the music. And to listen, you know, whatever. And he goes, and I don't, and, you know, stands up, turns around, very Japanese drama style.
Hand on the chin.
I think hand in the air. And I don't hear a thing. And I'm sure, you know, when the financial crisis, you know, is happening, I'm sure they weren't going to, you know, thinking of metaphors. They're probably going, F you, it's your fault. F you.
Yeah.
But what was funny is, that, yeah, it's kind of tough. And if you look at the financial crisis and they talk about the derivatives and how they bundled all these financial products together and using equations and formulas to determine kind of weighing the risk factor, risk versus reward. So, of course, derivatives are really tough. Even financial, like even economists don't really understand derivatives. So, they of course, they have, you know, the character playing the dummy so that they could kind of like have an excuse to kind of dumb down the language for the audience, which is fine. It's just that everybody seemed to be a dummy. Every time it came up, it was like, oh, I can't read these screens. Just tell me what it is, you know? The other guy's like, well, what does that mean? He goes, oh, don't ask me. I don't know. And then, so by the third time, and that was like Jeremy Irons. And prior to this like big important meeting, Simon Baker's character says, oh, and whatever you do, be honest, because he'll be the smartest guy in the room. No one else. You'll never be as smart as him. So of course, as soon as Jeremy Irons comes in, he's like, I'm not where I am because of my brains. So, no, well, according to Simon Baker, you are. He's like, talk to me like I'm a 10-year-old child, like I'm a Cocker Spaniel. I probably wouldn't explain anything to the Cocker Spaniel other than you're probably going to be eating like the cheap stuff for a while. But so then they kind of do that. But it kind of made me think, is like, would it have really hurt the movie if, At one point, the guy just kind of like talked normally and explained what these products are instead of like dumbing it down. Sure, we don't understand what it is, but we would kind of understand. Well, that sounds very serious.
Well, I mean, it could be like technobabble in Star Trek. It doesn't have any meaning. It just sounds impressive.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, you could do that. They kind of did that in Star Wars too. Or like in ER, the doctors speak, air quote, doctor speak. Yeah, like as you said, it doesn't really matter if we understand it or not, but the fact is it sounds real and it makes whatever media you're watching feel more real and more believable because the people sound the part. You know, like it's you do kind of need like the everyman character if you have like a story that's complex or very different from what the audience is going to be seeing. But if everybody's like the everyman character, kind of like, you know, breaks that suspension of disbelief. You're like, hold on. If all you guys need it to be dumbed down, I kind of see what the market is.
It's kind of funny. And even in the explanation, the actor is Zachary Quinto, the guy from Heroes, is like, well, as you know, as you are aware of, well, yeah, if he's aware, then you probably just speak normally. You know?
Yeah, right.
And by the way, I shouldn't have to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
I don't understand the line. They didn't hire me for my brain. Why would they have hired him otherwise?
Rakish good looks.
Maybe for his Cocker Spaniel-like abilities?
Well, I think he said like he got to where he was because of his ability to hear the music.
Ah, that's right, yes.
And then, of course, the other guy has to go with the analogy because the audience can understand that. And he's like, well, using your analogy... But I think it was more of a metaphor. But anyway, he said, you know, right now the music slowed. But if the music actually stopped, clear as mud now. Thanks.
Yeah, well, you can't really expect the audience to know what's going on. One of the last movies I saw in this like great theater back home was like The Matrix. You know, and yeah. You remember the scene where Keanu Reeves, spoiler, remember the scene where Keanu Reeves like wakes up from the pod and Lawrence Fishburne says, you know, you can't see because you haven't used your eyes.
Yeah.
I remember watching that with my dad in the theater and you just hear this ghetto voice from the back going, why he can't see? Why he all white like that? And I'm just like, oh, geez, he just said it, you know? So don't assume the audience knows what's going on.
Or assume that they'll be quiet.
Where you do a standard disclaimer that you are from the ghetto?
No.
So you can do the ghetto voice?
I didn't bring it up until you did.
No, but you're doing the stereotypical ghetto voice.
That's the way the voice sounded. I was just saying. I was just keeping it real.
You two are so precious.
I'm trying to keep the hate mails a little bit down. But I think just the link at the games is, yeah, sometimes you get like sprinkling whatever you're saying with a bit of techno babble, as Chris said, yeah, it really gives it that authenticity. And you know, it doesn't matter. Just like what Michael Crichton was saying when he started the ER, he was like, it doesn't matter if they understand what the paramedic is really saying to the doctor. They kind of get the person's in trouble. The doctor's going to try to save them. Same with margin call. It doesn't matter really if people understand about these derivatives or these mortgage bundles. And although a lot of people probably know a little bit more now because of the crisis. They understand big financial crisis. I recall there being a big recession. Solution was pretty simple. The guy's like, well, we got to sell it all. And people kind of understand the idea of buying and selling. So, nope, spoiler. Actually, that solution is based on what really happened. I forget which.
Not a spoiler.
Gosh, I forget which firm it was. It was maybe Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs, but they got the jump on the other ones. And they basically like sold off all the bad product to the other firms. And that's, you know, a firm like Lehman Brothers is like stuck with all this like toxic. Yeah.
It was like hot potato.
Yeah. And the music stopped.
And musical chairs.
Yeah. Wow, that sounds really planned, didn't it?
And you guys saw the forums. One of our frequent posters, Matt, posted a little something about game booth girls. Game booth girl. Yeah, I guess that you call them that, eh?
Booth babes.
Booth babes?
That's the name that I know them by.
Okay.
Which is sexist.
By Lisa and Heather. But...
I know them as those girls that wouldn't take my picture with them.
The girls that wouldn't take my phone number.
It was an interesting article. At the end, I couldn't really tell if the person who wrote it was kind of pro or con. I think it was just kind of more, I don't know, just kind of calling attention to the recent uproar. There was a lot of stuff on Twitter a couple weeks ago about booth babes or, you know, the female models at E3, and kind of been following it because of that.
Yeah, I don't know. The people who wrote that article, I don't think they've ever been to a car show, to be honest.
Yeah, they use them a lot in Tokyo, the Tokyo car show.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A lot of car show girls, yeah. I think that's what they're called.
Race queens, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
I went to an IndyCar race when I was in Australia, and I think there were at least as many bikini-clad promotion women, I guess, around as there were people actually attending the race.
Oh, I'm sure.
My wife worked at the Tokyo car show one year, and she's like just working a booth for her company.
Mm-hmm.
The guys, the otaku, as they would say in Japanese, the nerds, they take pictures of any woman at the car show. Like, you're just working the booth, like, giving information and wearing, you know, basically a business suit. They still want to take your picture. So, this is pretty lame.
I've heard this before. Everybody is somebody's fetish. So,
yeah.
That sounded really creepy. Didn't
a little bit. Yeah, especially.
Yeah. Like, it sounded really bad. All right. the thing about the business suit, you know?
I was like, should I get defensive and saying, wow, she's everybody's fetish? Or should I go, well, she was my fetish? I was just like, I have nothing to say.
Sorry.
She has enormous feet. No, nothing's really working.
I was going to say, the thing in that article that stuck out to me was kind of the first image in the article was, you know, like a female booth model and...
Two of them.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, that wasn't the first picture. There was another picture in the article that in the background you could see a kind of, I hate to say it, but sort of a stereotypical nerd kind of guy taking a photo.
Yeah.
In the back of this photo. And I mean, the guy didn't look creepy, but I think that's the image that people kind of associate you know, the guys who go to these conventions because of these female models, you know? And I kind of didn't explain that very well. Sorry.
I'd be reluctant to approach a booth if it had a lot of booth babes in it, because I wouldn't want them to think that I was approaching the booth because it had the booth babes.
Right.
You know, because you would kind of feel like a loser. Hmm. Yeah.
Well, then you approach the booth and not the babes.
Yeah, but if like, if they're the booth babes and they're like there at the booth, okay, they might be off somewhere else, but if they're like right there at the booth and you can't get past them, which I'm not saying is always the case, but...
No, that would just be a shame. That'd be terrible. Here I am having to talk to these beautiful women. Heaven forbid.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of agree with Lon. You know, I don't really want to have people assume that that's what a gamer is.
All right, in this episode, we're not going to have an entry in our D&D Next Diary. What we're going to do is debut a new series called Locales. And that's where we're going to look at a particular location, perhaps a city, a country, real or fictional, and talk about how either playing there would be pretty fun or how you could take elements from there and add it to your game, which seems to be the standard approach we take to everything.
Yeah.
So this episode, we're going to look at ships, be it battleships, submarines, spaceships, other types of warships.
Rowboats.
No.
That's okay.
Jefferson Starship. No. You remember Starship, the band?
No.
No. All right. Forget it. It's one. They have a song about Philadelphia.
Which means I automatically have to know it.
Does it include lyrics about cream cheese?
Oh, it's about rock and roll. We built the city on rock and roll.
Ah, yeah. I do know that band then.
Anyway, I spent too much time on Starship, the band. We're probably spending more time on Starships, the locales.
Oh.
So first we're going to look at how to use ships as a setting, and then we're going to move on and talk about how to use them as a character. So what's special about ships?
They float. Sorry. No, that was pretty lame.
Sorry, my fault. I set that up wrong. What's special and interesting about ships as a setting? So one of the first things we thought of was that they're, of course, the cramped quarters. Classic example, Das Boot, I think, does a really good job of emphasizing that. Run silent, run deep, although it doesn't emphasize it. You can certainly see about the tight confines on that submarine.
I thought even though it kind of got panned by critics, we kind of liked it. Even I thought Battleship did an okay job of, you know, kind of conveying the tight quarters on the ship.
You know, I'm actually happy you said that, because I wanted to bring that up too, but I felt kind of guilty about using that as a good example of a ship. But yeah, absolutely. I think the way that they were running between the quarters and had to watch their heads when they were going through the little bulkhead doors, it was good.
Yeah, Battlestar Galactica does a pretty good job as well. Yeah.
Yeah, the ship seems to have a lot of character, though the Galactica does.
And then the classic scene when in A New Hope, can you imagine that anywhere else? Like, they're coming through the ship and there's that tight corridor. And because it's, like, cramped, they got nowhere else to go. I mean, this battle is going to happen here, or it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a lot more intense because of those narrow confines. And I don't know, if you could compare, like, the big sweeping battles from other movies, and they just don't have, like, the same weight or intensity because everything is so open.
Kind of jumping around here, but I think that's also an exciting thing about playing or using a ship as a setting, is that you do have that juxtaposition or that contrast between the really tight quarters, but then perhaps a big open battlefield, or the open seas, the open space, the exploration, the craziness, the vastness. So yeah, it almost gives you the best of both worlds.
Now, I'm glad you brought up Battlestar Galactica, because even though the Vipers aren't technically a ship, there is this weird juxtaposition of how tight and compact and immobile the pilot is inside the Viper, compared with all this vast, open, empty space outside of them.
Well, I mean, that's something that goes for ships in general. Regardless of how much you're able to move around within the ship, be it like the inside of the Enterprise or the inside of a single Viper, you're still trapped in some sense or another, because you're in a ship, you're far away from the rest of the land. There's a sense of isolation that carries around it.
Which is our next point, isolated. Which I think goes hand in hand with, of course, it being cramped. Not only is it cramped, or like there's nowhere to go, nowhere to move. And one thing is like, yeah, you are isolated. So it helps to really focus the game if you're going to incorporate that. Yeah, you could have a political game. We've talked about a game that we've wanted to do for a long time, a Battletech game set on a warship. Of course, not using mechs, but there was a Battletech novel that actually a large portion of it was this political intrigue that was going on a warship. And it kind of forces people together. And an exciting thing I find, from the lowest person to the highest person on the ship, there's not a lot of separation between you two, both socially or physically. So a political game, the stakes are much higher.
Absolutely. All of the people on the ship rely on each other for their survival. Even the lowest guys, they're sitting there, for example, in a starship, maintaining the atmosphere.
Yeah, there's not a lot of fat on a ship.
That made me think of the Enterprise, and Star Trek The Next Generation was the Star Trek I started watching, so that's what I think of when I think of the Enterprise. But yeah, it's a ship, it's isolated, it's obviously more cramped than people would be outside of the ship, but in that one, you never really got the sense of claustrophobia, or you never really got the sense that everything was very compact and small. So I think that's a good example of what?
Of design. The way the ship was laid out was really important. In fact, Star Trek The Next Generation specifically, I think they won some awards for the way they laid it out. And the U.S. Navy actually took the interior designs of some of the rooms, the bridge specifically, as ideas for using in their future ships, because it didn't keep that kind of claustrophobic sense. It had a very open and utilitarian sense to it.
Really, I never really got the sense it was utilitarian. I always got the sense that you never really knew how big it was, and it always felt to me like, oh, now we're in this room, which I've never seen before, but I guess was on the ship somewhere, you know, or, oh, now we have all these passengers, and we don't really see where they stay, but they must stay somewhere. I guess my point is, like, on the Enterprise, I never really felt confined or in really tight quarters. It seemed like the ship was kind of expandable or contractible at will until mm-hmm. something kind of went wrong.
Yeah, I never really got a sense for how it seemed like a hotel.
Mm.
Yeah.
I mean, it had a bar in it.
Yeah.
Because the limitations of television, I mean, or even movies, you're only going to build so many sets. So they're always going back to the same sets over and over. So I felt like there was large portions of that ship that were unexplored. But you know something? The Star Destroyers, most of those ships are unexplored.
Hmm. I think the only thing we see is like the bridge and maybe like
Vader's place.
Yeah, Vader's place and hangar, I think.
Yeah, hallways 1 through 655.
Well, they all look the same.
Exactly. Oh, and the garbage chute. Don't forget the garbage chute.
You're thinking of the Death Star.
I am thinking of the Death Star.
Oh.
Well, I'm sure they have garbage chutes on Star Destroyers too.
Yeah, they jettisoned all that garbage. The Millennium
That's right.
When Boba Fett.
And then we float away with the rest of the garbage.
Yeah.
Is that our Star Wars quota for the day?
Oh, we're on spaceships. It's all right.
But let's not forget shows like Horatio Hornblower, also a book series. That's really good just to give you an idea of what it would be like to live on one of those sailing ships.
That really must have sucked.
Yeah, you definitely get that sense. Yeah, because even the officers don't have much space. And that was interesting about Run Silent, Run Deep. And people who haven't seen that movie, it's Clark Gable and Burt Lancaster. And it's set on a submarine in World War II. Mm-hmm. And unlike DOS Boat, which were really kind of emphasizes, you know, the sweaty, cramped, uncomfortable conditions of a submarine, this has got another agenda. But you still see that, you know, everybody's walking around with like sweat stains and the officer's mess, if that's what they call it on a submarine, I'm not sure. And the enlisted men's mess or the sailor's mess, like right next to each other. Mm-hmm. And there's like no space anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that I like about TV shows. For example, I'm thinking of Firefly with The Serenity, is that the cramped conditions, it forces politics onto you. You can't but help running into the other people on this ship, so you have to interact whether you like it or not. There is no going off alone, because there's nowhere to be alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk about even if you make it a little bit bigger, because Firefly is a good example, or the Millennium Falcon, they're good examples of like kind of a party ship. And if you remember A New Hope, you know, Han Solo and Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Yeah, the others. who else is in Star Wars? It'll come to me later. They bond on the Millennium Falcon when they're flying to Alderaan. So you have that. And the same with the Firefly. You know, Jane kind of knocks heads with other people, but, you know, they kind of build that bond. Or then you broaden it to something like a Star Destroyer or the Enterprise.
When Vader really bonds with the generals.
But it's like a self-contained city, and the players they've got some freedom, but it is limited, and you've helped confine it.
So it's almost kind of like a sandbox.
Yeah. with airlocks.
I meant more like
the safe getting out.
I meant more like the game style. Because, like, I guess, and so if you do have a big enough ship, as you said, the players can kind of go anywhere. They can do a lot of exploring, but it's within confines. So you don't have to worry about them going completely off the map.
Yeah.
You kind of always know where they will be, but there's a lot in there that they can explore.
Yeah.
That reminds me, one of the supplements for Eclipse Phase that I thought was a really great supplement was a detail of a scum fleet. So it wasn't a single ship. It was a collection of ships.
Well, that sounds
so good. There was like this, the sandboxing reminded me, there's kind of like one central ship and then sort of the smaller accompanying ships that would be around it.
Yeah.
And it was a completely sort of repurposed barge, and the people had like walled off sections and turned them into different kinds of, not habitats, but sort of like different groups owned different sections. And so they kind of functioned as different things, and they were sort of different parts. And that would have been a great place to explore, because you can repurpose sort of any section of this giant ship into sort of you, the game master, as whatever you want. I mean, I think they even had like a section that was completely walled off and filled with water for the whale and dolphin biomorphs that would be in there. So I thought that was really cool.
It reminds me of the Battlestar Galactica fleet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, and that's like just taking that the step further. You got the party ship, you know, the kind of the city ship, if you will, and now you've got a little bit of a world. And if you watch like Battlestar Galactica, the TV series, you know, they go to a ship and there's a whole episode on this other ship with different problems, but it's still kind of following that same thread. It's a good way to do like a monster of the week, but with kind of an overarching mythology.
Yeah.
Because you're still on the same fleet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that's a good way to do or bring in NPCs.
Yeah.
Because, like we said in that Apocalypse World game, hey, don't we know everybody?
Yeah.
It could be like, oh, they just transferred from one of the other ships in your fleet.
Yeah. You could do that like a kind of a fantasy fleet. Maybe not a realistic sailing ship, because it'd be like, let's go on to a virtually identical sailing ship.
Yeah.
And have an adventure there. We'll walk the 30 meters. Yeah, I think we've seen it all.
Hold on, this ship's exactly identical to the one we were on.
Yep, crappy food. Uncouth sailors. Yep, I think we've done it.
No, but
murder mystery on it. Well, it doesn't matter. It's one of you guys. I mean,
that could actually be really interesting to just, I mean, I don't know how long it would last, but that could really drive home the monotony, because being on a ship like that could be, or probably was, incredibly monotonous. You're like, great, you arrived there. It's the same thing you've seen for the past 27 days.
Because I think in a game, you really want to drive home the monotony.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because that makes any story hook you drop as the GM gold.
Because the players are clamoring for something to do.
The missing dog on this ship? Let's investigate.
You know, actually, the video game, Knights of the Old Republic, was pretty good for that. It was a Star Wars-based role-playing game, but they had the Ebon Hawk, there's an original idea, as the ship that you use traveling between the different worlds. In each world, you had a mission to do on it, but in between, you actually spent a lot of time on the ship, and it was completely freeform, but you could just go and talk to the NPCs and kind of figure out their backstories and find little secret areas on the ship. It was actually one of the most interesting parts of the game.
Another thing about using a ship as a setting is that it's kind of the small dangers that you can have, especially like, yeah, it could be sinking if you're on the water.
That's not a small danger.
Depends how slowly you're sinking.
All right. Well, you know what I mean? It's like, you know, there's orc hordes, big danger, drowning. Oh, I guess it is.
Big danger.
Small danger. I like the idea, though, of being on a ship and having orc hordes coming at you. They're swimming very quickly.
That's what I thought, too. Yeah. How is that orc horde traveling across the water? I don't know. They just are.
I'm sure they have ships, too. But, or on a spaceship, I mean, if you get, like, you watch Apollo 13, I guess suffocating is, maybe small danger is not the best choice.
Small in scale. It's big for you when it's going to end your life.
You know what I mean.
Small, because those little filters they had to rig up for the Apollo 13, those were pretty small.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for that bone.
Nice.
Actually, I was thinking those close quarters and sort of if you have one of those party ships, the problems kind of get magnified because you're kind of in such tight quarters and your world has kind of been shrunk to this ship. And so when things kind of start to go wrong on it, it's kind of a big problem. Like that episode of Serenity where they ran out of fuel. And the fuel ran the engine, which gave them life support. And once that runs out, kind of what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, and that's a big part of it, too. It's the smaller the ship is, the more limited your resources are. Something as part of any campaign on a ship could be just the constant search for resources. If you're at sea, you need water.
No, you don't. Water everywhere.
And not a drop to drink. Beats you! Ha!
Yeah, another thing that's important, or that's good about using a ship as a setting, is that it's mobile. So it allows you to kind of both be confined, but then you can like break away to give the players some options. It's like you're traveling from planet to planet, island to island.
Yeah. I like how that kind of combines with resources, because I think it's a nice juxtaposition, because
I didn't do that.
No, but I mean like the way the points juxtapose, you know? So yeah, if the PCs have a ship, if the characters have a ship, they can essentially go anywhere. Which is a lot for the GM to plan, you know. But then the GM says, okay, they only have so many resources. They only have fuel to get this far away, or they only have enough water to last this many weeks before they're going to have to refuel. And on the one hand, yeah, the players have all this mobility and they can go anywhere, but it's kind of in small jumps, or definitely planable. So I like the way that kind of works together and kind of limits the amount of work that the GM would have to do.
Oh, just whatever planet. I want to go to this planet. Oh, the desert planet? Is it a desert planet? It is now. That's what I planned. And you go to desert planet.
That can be a drawback of having like a highly mobile group. Mm-hmm. You know, if they can go anywhere, they say, yeah, we want to go over here to planet X. And you're like, well, I had kind of planned for you to go to planet Y, so...
Wormhole!
Oh, wormhole. Oh. I suppose, yeah.
But I mean, that's always part of it too. You know, as we said before, these ships can often be very dangerous. So if the players are hitting somewhere that you're not planned for, then throw one of the dangers in. They start sinking, or an oar cord bubbles up from the bottom.
I like that. They start singing.
You just can't stop.
Is there a Saint Vitus's song?
Yeah, that's good. And finally, another element was responsibility. A lot of times, like on the ship, everybody's kind of responsible for a different part of it. I mean, you can be a passenger, but generally, even if you watch something like Firefly, the passengers eventually take on a role.
It gets back to that thing we said about space. You know, a lot of these ships, there's not a lot of extra space, which means they don't have room for extraneous stuff, and that includes passengers. So you either kind of have to make yourself useful, or you might find that you don't have room on the ship anymore.
But that leads to a thing that a lot of, I think, people have when they're playing a game is, and we had when we played Hollowed Earth Expedition, is if there's kind of like ship-to-ship combat, everybody wants to be involved and wants to do something, and how to coordinate that.
Yeah, that can be really tricky, as we found out.
Yeah, it's good if everyone has a specific role to fill within the ship, especially one that can be leaned into combat of some sort, but especially in the case where we had Hollow Earth Expedition, a lot of the players didn't have any role to do on the ship, so it was there wasn't much for them to do. So it's always good to integrate something that everybody can do.
I think you just use the Star Wars Millennium Falcon role. Just like, all right, action's happening, everybody go do something.
Yeah.
They suddenly had an extra gun turret for Luke just to like start firing away on. Mm-hmm. Never saw it again, or before, but there it was. Come to think of it, Han Solo's gun turret didn't look anything like the actual gun turret you saw outside the ship.
It's called suspension of disbelief. Just go with it.
Yeah. Has that ever been explained?
Dude, you're talking about a movie where they can move stuff around with their mind. It's called The Force. I don't think you need to explain that.
But they look like bomber pits.
You're just not going to let this go, are you?
No. All right.
But I do agree with you. Like, one of the problems we did that I kind of stupidly did running Hollow Earth Expedition, I only put one gun turret on the ship.
So you should have did what they said. It was, man the guns. Well, what guns? The one that's right in front of you now.
Yeah, yeah.
That I just made up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't remember that on the diagram. Okay, then just sit there.
Okay, yeah. Then, yeah, yeah.
Sit there and dwell on that diagram that you saw.
Yeah. You just know and in yourself. How does that feel?
Jackies. Yeah. You know, though, actually, I've always thought that though I haven't tried it, the D&D 4th edition skill challenges would be really good for that. Because kind of if you had it with something like with Rogue Trader, where the ship moves along at its own pace, but you can do skill challenges. You kind of just nominate your action and validate it with a skill and perhaps a skill check. And then that can add bonuses to what the ship is doing on its own.
I think Rogue Trader has a good system where people, you know, kind of depend. I mean, they're all part of this crew, so it certainly makes it a lot easier. Yeah, but once the action happens, you know, they kind of got a list of things that they can do, or list of ways they can contribute. And then they make their skill roll, and all of that goes into how successful the ship as a whole is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I do like that. But I think unless that mechanic is in the game system, it can be pretty tough for the GM to come up with stuff on the fly that makes it feel like the player is contributing.
Well, that's why I recommend doing it with a skill challenge kind of thing. Let the player take a look at their own skills, their own abilities, and come up with some way that they can help.
And what happens when they say, great, I got...
art history.
Yeah, exactly. I got art history. And can I use that?
Hold on. I noticed the paint is a little bit thinner on the left hull, which suggests that perhaps then...
Yeah, like what I mean is I don't disagree that skill challenges would be good, because that's essentially what they are in Rogue Trader. But if you just keep giving like a few bonuses to the captain, it's going to get monotonous. And like, yeah, well, I did that last time. I as a player don't really feel like I'm contributing all that much to this fight.
Well, then you should take something other than art history, damn it.
If you play a game like Space Alert, where everybody's got to commit to an action and they put these cards face down under a certain time limit, and then when that's finished, you flip over and see if the actions actually coordinate with each other. That's a lot of fun. And kind of jury-rigging a system like that for an RPG, I think, would be a lot of fun. And we could kind of capture the coordination that you need. Like, if you look at something like, a movie like Battleship or Run Silent, Run Deep, and just like how the captain giving orders, and everything's got to be really well-timed. So, and you're giving, like, talking to each other and...
Yeah,
if it's like you go, okay, let's do this, let's do that, let's do that. Okay, everybody commit to their action now. Everybody writes it down. Then you flip it over, and did it actually work?
Mm. Yeah.
There's a system out there. It's kind of a universal system that's meant to be tacked on to any game that you have in ship combat, called Fill Thrust. And actually one of the mechanics that it uses is that you write down your action at the same time as the other players, and then you flip them over to determine what happens with the action. This one's specifically at the ship level, not at the player level, but it's still that same kind of idea.
Mm. Mm. Sounds great.
Well, the other thing that you could do is, if it's a small enough ship, you have events happen on the ship that the other players or the other characters have to take care of. You know, like you always see guys running around putting out fires for damage control. Or like you think of like Star Trek, they're always saying, you know, we need more energy going to the deflector shield. So someone has to go down to, you know, engineering and get the engines to cooperate. Like, not everybody would have to be involved in the fight, but they would have to feel like they're doing something.
Yeah.
I'd recommend, if you were going to do something like that, though, to kind of put it on a scale, like as soon as a ship takes this amount of damage or you're this many turns into the combat, because otherwise it might feel like you're being an adversarial GM. Oh, and now it's on fire. Good luck.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't just randomly say, and now the ship's on fire if it hasn't been hit yet.
Exactly, which is why I'm recommending having some kind of graded scale that follows along logistically rather than randomly.
Okay.
Yep.
And there's also like little things that are certainly specific to some genres, like... weightlessness or zero gravity. Like the BattleTech universe, they don't have artificial gravity. So there's a lot that they do with that. I mean, they even get to the point, I think there's a novel called Hunters of the Deep, and it's Clan Sea Fox. Don't worry about it if you don't know BattleTech. But they now just travel in their ships, these big like city ships, if you will, or community ships, and they're traders. But they don't really like going on the planets anymore, feeling like real gravity, because they're kind of just used to like zero gravity and the kind of the maneuvering. And I know a lot of games, especially Universal Systems, will have rules for zero gravity and whether or not your character is more adept or less adept at fighting or moving around and that. But that's one of the reasons why I really like the BattleTech universe for their spaceships, is the lack of artificial gravity. Hmm. It gives it a little something more.
There was a game called Jovian Chronicles that I played a long, long time ago, and whichever planet you came from affected your character's stats based on that. For example, if you were from the moon, which has a very low gravity, you were very good in zero G and had a like high dexterity in that atmosphere. But if you were something like from Earth or from one of the moons of Saturn that had a high gravity, then you were much stronger than characters who'd been raised in zero G environments just because of the weight of the planet.
Oh, I like that. And even think, it doesn't have to just be science fiction, because you're talking about like sea legs.
Mm.
And then if you do more fantasy, you just do more and more adaptations. And you just kind of exaggerate that. They literally are sea legs. I don't know what that literally would be, though.
Pillars of water?
Yeah. As soon as I said they're literally sea legs, I'm like, okay, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
All right, now moving on to the character, using it as a character. It's a little bit more unusual, but we certainly have some really clear examples of both the ship as a protagonist and as an antagonist. Protagonist first, we can look at the TV series Andromeda, where you had that very attractive hologram.
Yes.
And that represented the ship's AI. Supernova, where it had a female voice. Wow, this seems to be a theme here. Yeah, the really sexy female voice, and that was the ship. And in Supernova, it was used to good effect in that, if I remember correctly, where you can kind of outsmart the ship's directives.
So those like ship babes? Those like ship babes?
I don't know what that means.
Instead of booth babes.
I don't get it either.
Instead of booth babes, they're ship babes.
Okay.
Great.
Cut that out!
I think you better. I have no idea.
All right, cut
you
that out.
You explained it. I was like, what?
Keep it in!
Well, I was thinking, like, one example where the ship AI wasn't female was the TV series Red Dwarf. I mean, the shipboard computer was a guy for some of the seasons.
Was it the hologram guy?
No. There was actually There was an actual AI on the ship, and he was only visible on computer monitors. He ran the entire ship.
Oh, I see.
But then later on, they went into an alternate dimension, and they kept the female version of the AI, so he wasn't completely male.
Oh, okay.
The Moya from Farscape was neither male or female, but it was kind of the whole ship itself was an entity. So that was part of it. And I really like that one because the ship can adapt to its inhabitants. So if, for example, a human moves onto this ship and there's only other aliens, the human's room will slowly convert to carry oxygen in the atmosphere or something like that. It'll slowly. Grow a chair if needed.
Slowly. I like that.
We're done with your rooms there.
No, he doesn't need it anymore. Okay, now draining the oxygen again. Yeah.
That's funny. But like, I think that Moya from Farscape is a good example because even though the ship was like this vast biomechanical organism, it had that symbiotic pilot life form in it.
That's right, yeah.
That was much more character scale that could interact directly with the other people on the ship.
I know what you're saying. I'm not sure that's needed. If I compare like Andromeda, yeah, sure, you hire the actress and you have her there and yeah, she was pretty.
Right.
So
I'm not going to complain about that.
Yeah. You don't hear me complaining, people. But yeah, that it can attract more viewers. But if you watch Supernova, I'm not saying Supernova is a great movie, but...
Maybe slightly less than great. Really good?
Have you seen it?
No, I was just making fun of you.
I was like, I thought you were being sarcastic because it was probably pretty far from great. But it's just a disembodied voice. But I still think, it was still very credible that one person was very attached to the ship AI. And... it was very believable that they had formed this relationship, that they didn't need that non-ship form to convey a relationship.
I wasn't saying that, like, you should have, like, that pilot-type character from Farscape. I just saw that as that was kind of the hologram equivalent for Farscape.
Okay.
You know?
Was the pilot, like, about 2 inches tall?
No, he was, like, this big insect thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because you're doing, like little mini...
Oh, sorry. I guess... I suppose I did the mini hand scale to contrast with the vastness of the ship.
Oh, I see. I was picturing, like, a little G.I. Joe figure.
I'm your pilot!
Yeah. Now, I think it's very easy for people to see how to use that as an NPC. I mean, like, that could be, I think, a very effective NPC. And it doesn't necessarily have to be science fiction... I'm not terribly familiar with Spelljammer, but you could certainly have a kind of a
science fantasy.
Right. You can have like a fantastic AI. What was I supposed to say to science fantasy? Yeah.
I wasn't there to see it, but I saw that face.
Well, I didn't even know if it was a joke or not, or if Wayne was trying to help. <It's> like... Yes, thank you. Science fantasy. Thank you. Those who don't know Spelljammer. But you could have like kind of like this fantastic AI, some sort of spell, or like the whole ship is this giant magic item. Like, oh, I'm drawing a blank, but you know, like the talking sword and that artifact.
Yeah.
What are they called? Those?
Talking sword.
All right, good. So talking ship.
Oh, you could have the ship be a creature in itself. Have it be a really, really, really big dragon or a turtle.
Oh, that sounds really good. That reminds me of Torg and the Space God supplement, and they were all about biotech.
Hmm. Oh, cool.
Even like the Tyranids, imagine like, you know, everything's alive. Everything is sentient.
Well, but friendly.
Yeah.
Those friendly Tyranids.
Yeah, I'm thinking, imagine getting a Tyranid ship, and I'm like, I played that old Milton Bradley Space Crusade game. That kind of sucked.
Or even like kind of steampunk, like a clockwork ship mind. I think that would be pretty awesome. Like a little British accent. Hello.
A little twangy.
I'm your ship today.
Please wind me, sir. We'll run aground. And they call everybody Mister.
Oh, you just think anything that calls something Mister is funny.
A friend of mine has got a squirrel named Mr. Richardson. So I've imagined him as a little butler.
On the ship?
Yes. So next point.
Little tiny monocle.
Oh, the ship is a monocle.
Yeah, that's a monocle.
Well, it's like, speaking of the ships that are alive, that reminded me of this cheesy, I guess you would call it softcore porn sci-fi series, Lex.
Ah, yeah.
It's by no means good, but it's one of those things where it's like so bad it actually becomes good.
Okay.
You know? And the ship on that was like a biomechanical organism that could talk to the people inside it through just like this disembodied voice. But the thing is, the ship had to eat. And when the ship didn't eat, they couldn't really do anything with it. So
What did it eat?
It would just like ram itself into a planet or like blow a planet up and digest the chunks it made.
It ate planets.
Like a massive ship, like the size of like a Star Destroyer, basically.
Wow.
Okay. I think it was actually designed to be a doomsday device, but like some random astronaut named Stan got it.
That was pretty good. It was kind of like a very temperamental NPC, you know, because they'd say, oh, Lex, we need to do this. And he'd be like, no, I'm hungry. I'm not going to do anything until you feed me.
All right. And that moved along to Ship as an antagonist. Of course, the archetypical example is HAL from 2001, A Space Odyssey. I keep wanting to say Space Oddity.
You're thinking of the monolith for Space Oddity.
No, I'm thinking of David Bowie.
Oh.
But there's also, Wayne and I kind of debated about this at work. I guess we do work as well. But whether or not in the movie Event Horizon, is the antagonist the ship? Or, oh, sorry, spoiler. Is the antagonist the ship or is it one of the characters? I'm not going to tell you the characters so I don't spoil it.
Hmm.
Actually, I would say the ship. That was an example I was planning to bring up for the ship as antagonist for that. And even if it is the one character, I think the ship is still the major antagonist for the vast majority of the movie.
Yeah.
It could be. I was mostly on the fence about whether it was about the ship in Event Horizon was a location or more of a character.
It's a good point, yeah, it really is.
A good way to make a ship a bit more characterful, if not a complete character, is to give it a history or to give it some kind of...
Background?
Yeah, background. Because like a game, for example, like some games like Rogue Trader have a random kind of event table that you roll on for the ship. And you can get results like the ship actually kind of wants to get into fights. It's not that the ship becomes sentient. It's just that, you know, there's kind of this effect that builds up that kind of makes it a little bit more than just a piece of equipment.
It's a good point. I mean, yeah, I mean, you give it a name, it starts to get a personality. Mm. The Millennium Falcon doesn't have an AI, but it's got a history. It's a little bit temperamental.
I was about to say, I would argue it has a personality, kind of.
Okay. But then like, Luke's X-Wing has zero personality, much like Luke.
Burn!
Oh, snap.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember Fate. In Fate, they always described, like, fractal creation, and they said, make everything in the game like a character. And, of course, in Fate, you assign attributes to things, say, if they're excitable or strong or whatever, and put those kinds of things onto the ship.
Oh, absolutely. You find that, like, even kind of if you imagine, like, a land ship, like the 40K Titans. There's a novel by Dan Abnett that does a really good job of portraying... How, well, they kind of get like a soul and their own personality, even though they technically don't have what you call an AI.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, well, people, I mean, it's kind of classic for the captain. You know, you stay with a ship long enough, and whether it actually has a character or not, the people on it feel as if it does. I mean, like, even in Battlestar Galactica, the Galactica never really had a personality, but Captain Adama kind of treats it like a character.
And that's an important part of it, though. I mean, that's their home. That's where they live, and that's what keeps them alive. And that's something that you should, you know, go strong with in the game. Let the characters get in there. Let them name the ship. Let them customize it. The more they put into it, the more valuable it's going to be to them. And it'll be a character in its own right, without doing anything besides allowing them to give it its characteristics.
It reminds me of, like, the Friday Night Lights episode. And, of course, Friday Night Lights, where, like, kind of the team binds everybody together. And then here you have the ship binding everybody together. I remember when, I think it was called Titan Legions came out, which was part of the Epic rules for 40K. And the White Dwarf had like an article like describing these different legions. And one of them, they'd be in this Titan and they would jury-rig it with all these like bullhorns, and they fought the orcs a lot. And they were saying how they kind of took the orcs' personality. But then, of course, they're giving this Titan personality, and they would be chanting like, big death, big death, big death, through these like bullhorns.
In Orcish, of course.
I think it was in English or Gothic, High Gothic, whatever, whatever the 40K language is.
Yeah, which I'm sure orcs understand. But.
Yeah.
They're not ships at all, but that kind of reminds me a little bit of the Bond rules for the Warjacks and War Machine. Whereas if you do like campaign play, if your Warjacks survive a battle, you can roll on this table to see if they kind of develop a personality. And then you kind of roll again to see what kind of random personality that is. And of course, it has game effects, but it also gives you kind of like flavor. You know, like the thing becomes like bloodthirsty or cowardly or, you know, intractable or like a defender. So I could see doing something like that for a ship that the characters have in a game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Hey, but back to antagonists. Now that you've infused all this personality, it turns against you.
Well, we didn't say it was good personality.
Yeah. Just make sure they always roll antagonistic. and of course, because, I mean, we talked about as a setting, you can make a ship quite dangerous. And of course, if that ship controls the setting, I mean, if you imagine like, you know, the killer jungle, but now that it's the whole ship around you, it's something that you've come to rely on is now turned against you. Or of course, if you look at like Space Hulk or something like that, you enter in this strange ship.
Well, putting a ship as an antagonist too, it takes a bit of a balance act to it, because the ship, if it's in control, it can, you know, just vent all the oxygen and kill everyone right away. Mm-hmm. But so it almost has to have kind of a sadistic bent to it, because it wants to keep them alive but is still antagonistic towards the characters. Now, it can be a pretty horrible villain.
It could be like you have a mission and the mission's wrong, so the party doesn't want to do the mission, but the ship won't change its directive, but it still needs the party to do the mission. So it's more about control, or it could get it in its head, I guess metaphoric head, that it doesn't need the entire party, but it needs some of them. So it wouldn't jettison all the air, but then you could have like little death traps on the ship.
Oh, that's evil. Totally evil.
Well, plus, if you think about it, like most ship AIs, because we're kind of talking about AI here, are supposed to be incredibly smart, which means it kind of wouldn't just kill the people it didn't need then and there, because then it'd be like, the rest of the crew would be like, wait a minute, how is everybody in that one room when all the oxygen got vented out? It's kind of suspicious. So,
it's killing them secretly?
Or at least more subtly, you know, where it seems more like an accident, you know, strung out over a longer period of time, you know.
It's a new locked room mystery.
Yeah.
But how did anybody get in here? It didn't matter. It was a ship.
But no, like, and it also wouldn't have to be, I guess, completely deadly. Like a comical example was, again, like Red Dwarf. Like in one episode, they activated a backup AI because they pissed off the original AI. And where they had been getting everything for free, the new AI said, no, now you have to work for your food. You're eating too much. Your daily rations are cut in half, and now you have to work for it. It was pretty funny.
This reminds me of, although it's not a ship, I think the computer's called Alice in Resident Evil.
Hmm.
And I don't know, it just made me think you can kind of negotiate, like you're saying, you know, of course, sure, that's a comical example, but you can negotiate with the ship.
Hmm.
It needs you to do certain things, but you're spending the kind of the long game is you want to disable the ship or take over the ship, and its long game is whatever, but you've got to like make these little deals in the short term.
Yeah, like that could actually be really, really interesting in that you can negotiate and manipulate the ship, because unless the ship is like self-sustaining, or unless the ship or the AI has lots of mobile little drones or other external robots, there's places you could probably go where it can't get to, or it can't repair itself. It can't do maintenance on itself.
Avoiding the cameras and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like
the Logic Core in Discovery 1 where they disabled HAL.
Yeah, yeah.
Dave.
And then, of course, if you're the GM, you have to do that creepy voice that gets slower and slower as they pull out more wires.
Daisy,
Dave.
Just kidding, Dave.
That would be really good.
Right? Afterwards, I'm fine, Dave.
Yeah. That would be pretty funny.
Well, that was the first in our locale series. Now, it was a bit unusual to kick off that we chose ships, but as we said before, we will also be doing things like choosing a particular city or a particular mystical place and different things you can do with that locale. All right.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. Check us out online, www.idleredhands.com, metalredhands.com. You can listen to the episodes right there on the website or stream them through iTunes, listen to them through Stitcher, or download them off of DriveThruRPG. You can also post comments on our forums on the website, follow us on Twitter or Facebook, or send us an email, because we always love hearing from all of you guys. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Don't turn me off, Dave.
DriveThruRPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. DriveThruRPG, the one true source for RPGs.
Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.
We were just talking about Lex. Because I remember, like, I got, like, a DVD of it for my, like, my birthday, because my dad got it for me, because everybody liked the show. And I remember, like...
Your family watched soft pornography together? That's weird.
All right. Well, excuse me for liking something weird.
It was just a crappy B-rate TV show that relied a lot on risque situations.
Yeah.
Sorry, you don't find it strange that his dad, like, buying him soft porn because they all like it?
There was nudity on the TV.
How is it soft porn if there's no nudity?
Like, there was always, like, leading up to sexual situation stuff, but...
Oh, but there's no nudity.
No.
No.
Not on the TV show. So, if I could have finished my story, Mr. Interrupter, we pop in the DVD, and we're like, whoa, that's fucking nipple. I don't remember that on the TV. That was awkward.
Yeah.
See?